Sapiens zu dem
der Teme, jeden arrumpierte Lavrovs Period.
My topic is Jews around period. I shall follow closely the outline which has been distributed here. I would start with discussing the importance of period. Then I shall analyze the attitude of period toward Jewish question. I shall examine the Jewish socialists who are connected with period, then the socialist Jews. And finally, I shall deal with Jewish Lavrists. The period of 70s represents an important phase in the history of social movement in Russia. Within that decade, ideas and groups emerged whose influence came to discern in events that preceded and that followed the revolution of 1917. One of the well-known groups of that time were the so-called Lavrists or Periodovtsy, named after the publication of Period Forward, founded and edited by Pyotr Lavrov, which saw the light in 1873 in Zurich, Switzerland, and which was discontinued in London in 1877. Period never succeeded in building up a numerous following. The teachings of its editor never were dominant among the Russian young people who embraced the socialist faith, the majority of whom stood under the spell of Mikhail Bakunin. His youthful adherents liked to recite, referring to Lavrov, the following parody attributed to Dmitry Clements, which I'll quote in Russian. I am sure everybody understands here. Ex-professor, ex-philosoph, revolutsia plot. Он сидит верхом на раке и кричит вперед, вперед. Yet, for the year 73-77, Period had been, so to speak, the address of the young Russia that struggled against the regime of the omnipotent Tsar, the only available forum for discussion of serious problems, a forum which appeared at regular intervals. Period enjoyed a solid reputation among both friends and enemies. The Soviet historiography, which has followed and has vulgarized the traditional point of view of the Russian Marxists, considers all the various currents of the Narodnichtstvo in the 70s and the beginning of the 80s as mere stages in the gradual diffusion of the tenets of Marxism in Russia, and views their history as, to use the words of Engels, the development from utopia to science, from utopie zur Wissenschaft. This is an erroneous view. Actually, the Narodnichtstvo reflected answers to the problems which also existed in the following decennia, with which Marxism too had to deal, and which even determined the great schism within the Russian Social Democratic Party 30, 40 years later. A passage from a brochure written in 1874 by Lavrov against Tkachev will illustrate this point. I'm quoting, "History has proved, and psychology convinces us, that any unlimited puissance and dictatorship corrupts the best men, and that even geniuses who wanted to make nations happy by decrees were not able to materialize their goals. Any dictatorship has to surround itself with overpowering force, blindly obedient tools. Any dictatorship has to put down not only reactionaries, but also those who simply do not agree with the ways of his acting. The party which succeeded in establishing a dictatorship would be able to renounce it, one can dream only before dictatorship has been set up." Outquote. Thus, period forms a part of the prehistory of the 10 days which shook the world. The study of the period story is greatly facilitated by the documentation gathered by its permanent secretary, the undeservedly forgotten Russian idealist and socialist, Valery Nikolaevich Smirnov. his archives preserved by his widow, Nadezhda Konachevskaya, and his son, Valerian, were turned over to the International Institute for Social History, Amsterdam, and I was privileged to make copious notes from them prior to World War II, when the bulk of this collection was lost. The importance of Period and of the Lavrist in the evolution of the socialist ideas and groups in Russia had been recognized by historians from Thun to Franco Venturi. Its role in the dissemination of the socialist credo, or credo you say, among Russian Jews has never been seriously disputed, although seldom recorded in concrete terms. Of the leading Lavrists, only Nikolai Kulapko-Karetsky left memoirs, but he, as well as Lavrov, who compiled an interesting outline of the main phases of the Narodnichstvo, Narodniki Propagandisti, were not exceedingly interested in the Jewish aspect of their oeuvre. They touched only in passing this topic and, if at all, referred to Lieberman, whose Jewish socialism captivated their imagination. There was no reason for them to indicate or to dwell on Jewish origin of socialist Jews in their midst, who never associated themselves with any Jewish cause or aspirations. The outsider who did it many years afterwards knew too little about the internal affairs of Period and therefore either exaggerated its influence among Jews or underestimated the importance of leading Jewish Lavrists, or, which was much more often, left out names of several Jews who belonged to the story. A sweeping statement by Lev Deitch that, I'm quoting, Jews in their majority, he means Jewish revolutionaries in the 70s, joined the Lavrists, has been already contended before it was published. Pavel Axelrod, whom Deitch asked for an advice, warned his old friend that his idea was a product of imagination. Deitch exaggerated, of course, but there were Jews within the Lavrists and around Period, and I'm going to examine first Jewish socialists among them, then socialist Jews connected with Period, and finally Jewish Lavrists and Period's partisans among them, among Jews. The connection of Period with Aaron Lieberman and his group of Jewish socialists, considered as initiators of the Jewish socialist and labor movement, is well known. Here is not the place even to summarize manifold studies on Lieberman. We want all solely to recapitulate the most striking points in the relationship between Period and the pioneers of the Jewish socialism. Lieberman escaped from Vilna in the summer of 1875 and was introduced to the editorial circle of Period, then in London, by the leader of the Lavrists in Russia, Lev Ginzburg, about whom I will have to tell much more a little later. In London, Lieberman learned a compositor's trade and became typesetter in the printing shop of Period. He also illustrated some pamphlets put out by Period. Last but not least, he wrote a series of articles for the Period. During his stay in London, Lieberman launched an appeal to the young Jewish intelligentsia and drafted the charter of a Jewish socialist section of the so-called Russian Social Revolutionary Party, both of which were conceived and executed in the spirit of the Russian socialist ideas of that time. In his appeal, Lieberman refers to the debt of the Jewish intelligentsia towards the Jewish proletariat and urges the Jewish youth to go into the people, Itziv Narod. Apropos, Lieberman envisaged the building up of the socialist cadres in the same manner as Period and his editor, Pyotr Lavrov. It asked the intelligentsia should disseminate socialist notions among working classes, bring up conscious men and women, and then cede to the really people's intelligentsia the leadership. Exactly this role recommended Lieberman to the Jewish academic and high school students. From Smirnov's letters to his first wife, Rosalia Idelson, to whom we consign a special chapter, we do know that Lieberman discussed thoroughly with Lavrov and Smirnov the appeal to the young Jewish intelligentsia published by him in Period, and that there existed a draft of this appeal which Lieberman destroyed under the impact of critical comments made by Lavrov and Smirnov, whom Lieberman asked for advice. Even much closer was the cooperation between Lieberman and Period in preparation of the charter of a Jewish section of the so-called Russian Social Revolutionary Party. Letters by Smirnov and by Lavrov to Rosala Edelson present evidence of the active participation of Lavrov in writing up the charter. Besides, the wording of the charter reflects to such an extent the personal views of Lavrov, is full of favorite expression and thoughts of the latter, that it should be considered at least a common document of both Lavrov and Lieberman. The perusal of the booklet to the Russian Social Revolutionary Youth, written by Lavrov against Khrushchev in 1874, and of his book Government the Society of the Future, Государственный элемент будущего общества, published in 1976, would prove this point. Вперед had also its share in the establishment of the first Jewish socialist organization, Agudas HaSocialistim HaYivrim, set up in London in May 1876. To begin with, the most articulate of the 10 founding members of the Agudas were Lieberman, Goldenberg, Sapper, and Weiner. The first two formed a part of the Sperot technical staff, and Sapper and Weiner belonged to the readers and admirers of the publication who, as long as they had remained interested in public affairs, got their political mode order from Sperot, and who, after discontinuance of Sperot, maintained close contact with Lavrov and Smirnov. Furthermore, the plan to establish the Agudas emerged in the midst of the Sperot community in London, and it's not clear at all whether or not it was Lieberman who conceived this plan. In his letters to Rosella Edelson, Smirnov claims that it was he who suggested to found a Jewish socialist group as a vehicle for organization of trade unions in Whitechapel. Be that as may, the Agudas was not the favorite child of Lieberman, who had remained faithful to his vision, publication of a Jewish socialist newspaper, and who found ways and means to put out her MS in 1877. The bylaws of the Agudas, written by Lieberman, were published in Sperot, and it was typical for a pupil of Lavrov to insert there that the relationship of the Agudas members in and outside of the organization should be based on truth, justice, and morality, pravda, spravedlivost, and nravstvennost. Sperot welcomed emphatically the birth of Agudas and extended on this occasion greetings to Jewish workers, referring to them in Russian is bratsya po delu chelovechestvu. I cannot render in English, in French I would say frère par la cause de l'humanité. I don't have to say it in English. Who have to overcome many more difficulties than their Russian fellow fighters. The author of these encouraging words was nobody else than Valerian Smirnov. Sperot stood out for his attitude in the Jewish question. Not that the cosmopolitan outlook of Lavrov and Smirnov formed an exception. On the contrary, it was rather the rule. But Lavrov and Smirnov were consistent and never adhered to the facile generalizations current in certain social circles of the 70s, and even condoned by some Jewish revolutionaries who themselves did not refrain from referring to Jews as kikes, jidy, and viewed the Jews as a parasitic nation which exploits poor peasants and worships a golden calf. Lavrov and Smirnov see their period clear of any anti-Semitic allusions, not to speak of direct anti-Jewish attacks. Thus, they refused to print an Ukrainian translation of a Russian socialist pamphlet provided by a translator at his own initiative with anti-Semitic slogans. They actually rewrote a story received from Moscow under the heading A Storm is Near, Budit Buria, in order not to print characteristics of Jews used by the author of the story, which could be misinterpreted by Jew baiters. They were perfectly aware of the smoldering distrust against Jews, primarily among certain Ukrainian socialists. Thus, Sergei Podolinsky, a well-known socialist leader in the Ukraine, an old acquaintance of Ginsburg, Smirnov, and Rosala Edelson, a man who played not the last role in the organization of Period, wrote to Smirnov in 1976, I quote, "Except for a few cases which do not warrant special attention, I deny the existence and even the possibility of the existence in Russia, not only in the Ukraine, a socialist Jidy, completely sincere in their behavior as a socialist should be." Output. Maybe for this reason, Sperot preferred to drop for a correspondence published under the signature Moskvich, a paragraph which read, I'm quoting, "You Jewish young people, cast off any softness and compliance. One of your core religionists showed weakness in the third department, Третье отделение, where he had been for 2 months only, and now he tears his hair outward. Maybe for similar reasons, or following the old adage, quieta non movere, Vpilot refrained from placing an impassionate indictment of antisemitic feelings among Russian socialists under the heading prejudices of our social revolutionaries against Jews, predrasudki protiv evreev. This indictment, in the form of a lengthy article, reached Period in 1876 from Russia via Berlin. In Berlin at that time existed a group of academic students from Russia, almost exclusively Jewish, closely connected with Liberal and known as Berlin Section, or even Jewish Section. This group acted as liaison between Russian revolutionaries in their native country and in emigration. When the article, Prejudices Against Jews, arrived in Berlin, Grigory Gurevich, a leading member of the Berlin Section and a future co-defendant of Lieberman in the Berlin trial of April 79, decided to keep it for a while to get acquainted with its contents. Later, he mailed the prejudices to London and let Spirot know that he and the Berlin Section did not approve of the manuscript. The author of the prejudice remains unknown. It would hardly be an exaggeration to state that in the 70s, as a matter of fact in the 80s and 90s, until the emergence of the Soyuz Social Demokratov and of the Bund, Spirot and the Lavris had been the only Russian revolutionary group that actively supported aspirations of the Jewish socialists and stimulated the building up of a Jewish socialist movement. An attempt in this direction was made in the 80s by Mikhail Gregomanov, an Ukrainian leader, but nothing came of his efforts and very little is known about the circumstances in which they were undertaken. Closely associated with Spirot, the Jewish socialists, such as Lieberman and his supporters in the Berlin Section, were not Lavris. The same holds true of the Vilna Circle Kruzhok, liquidated by the police in June 75. The Jewish socialists in London, Berlin, and Vilna, although influenced in many respects by Lavrov and his mouthpiece period, did not consider themselves and hardly were regarded by others as periodists. In the course of its multifarious activities, Period attracted, came to know, and dealt with a number of Jews about whom it is not always easy to say whether or not they were Jewish socialists in the sense that Liberman was one, but who in no way were Lavris. Thus, names of men like Arkady Finkelstein, Lazar Goldenberg, Mark Nathanson, Aaron Zundelevich, and of young women like Anna Epstein, Betty Kaminska, are to be found in the archives gathered by Smirnov. I refer only to the Jewish people more en vue in the 70s who either wrote letters or approached Period or rendered services to the publication of Lavrov. Some of them were lived even on the premises of Period's premises in London. For instance, Goldenberg, who worked in the Period printing shop. Nathanson was the man who in 1876 succeeded in arranging for a short while a merger of Period with other Russian revolutionary faction. Nevertheless, none of them identified themselves with the Period group. Anna Epstein, who became wife of Dmitry Clements, Betty Kaminska, co-defendant of Lubatovich, Bardin, and others, in the so-called trial of 50, Proces 50, in March 77, sympathized with the Bakunists. Nathanson, the father of the Zemla Evola, did not share the political views of Period. Goldenberg joined the technical staff of Period as a result of the unifying action of Nathanson and represented in London other factions than Lavris. There remained Finkelstein and Zundelevich, about whom one is entitled to question their political allegiance in the 70s. As far as Finkelstein, the main personage in the Vilna Kruzhok of 72 is concerned, who between 73 and the beginning of 76 lived in Königsberg and had been forwarding вперед to Russia. Apropos, in 75, his report on Vilna was published in the Chemnitzer Freie Presse. There is a letter by Ginzburg of January 5, 1974, in which the leader of the lovers in Russia refers to Finkelstein as a friend of the Bakunists. In another letter written on the next day, Ginzburg, who at that time was busy establishing channels for smuggling Spirot to Russia, pointed out that he did not want to initiate Finkelstein into his dealings with smugglers because Finkelstein maintained close contacts with Mikhail Sazhin, Armao Ross, head of the Bakunist caucus. Such was situation 74. It may be that later Finkelstein changed his mind. In the period, there are two articles by Finkelstein from Königsberg and German administration courts and press subservient to Russia. After Finkelstein had to escape from Germany and went to Paris, where he took over the apartment of German Lopatin, his traces disappeared from the annals of the period. Quite different was the case of Aaron Sundelevich, this admirable figure of a Russian Jewish revolutionary of the 70s. His biography is known enough. It will be touched upon here solely as far as his relationship with the period is concerned. Beginning about mid-75, first together with Finkelstein in Königsberg, and from 76 and up, alone in Memel and in Berlin, Moshe, or Zund, as he was called tenderly by his friends, had been postmaster general, as well as minister of communication of the period. He also was associated with Lieberman and advised him in question pertaining to the publication of the HMS. Zundelevich, who read the period in Vilna prior to his escape from there in June 75, appreciated the high-level publication and, as a man, well-organized man, highly rated the regularity of his appearance. As long as there were no other organs to compare with and no other revolutionary groups able not only to proclaim but also successfully to implement a different political outlook than that of the period, Zundelevich remained faithful to the Lavrists without being one of them. As a matter of fact, like his predecessor Finkelstein, he never limited his service to the period only, although in a letter to Smirnov of November 75, he referred to the period as our newspaper. This changed later on. Natanson, who early in 76 negotiated a merger of all revolutionary factions in a united organization, visited Zundelevich and drafted him for his plans, which led towards founding of Zemlya Vola. In the meantime, Zundelevich followed from his Königsberg Memel Berlin vantage position in developments in Germany, i.e. the progress of the Social Democratic Party, and grasped faster than many other Narodniki in and outside Russia the enormous importance of political freedom for his native country. He also realized that the political action there required methods not acceptable to the period people, and he moved away from them. After having received and read the volume 5 of the period in 1877, he wrote to Kulavko Koretsky in December 77, I'm quoting, "I still regard you and your friends as my comrades in general, but not in a narrow sense of this term. You refuse to understand that Russia is a land where nothing else can be done but pushes outward." You want to tell me something? No. So far, we dwelt on the periphery of the period, and it was there they were able to lead Jewish socialists as well as socialist Jews, some of whom were more and some were less, and some were not at all influenced by Lavrov theories, but none of whom could be identified with the Lavrists. If we now take up the internal circle of the period and its followers, we meet Lavrists in the proper sense of this word. Two, and the most important of them, have been known to historians of the 70s. Their actual role, however, has never been spelled out. In the Studies in History, Volume 3, published by Ivo in 1939 in Vilna, the late Cherikover refers to these two Lavris, Lev Savirievich Ginzburg and Razalia Christofovna Yerson, as follows. In the literature, he writes, unfortunately, there are very few data regarding these two representatives of the Lavris. Lev Deitch does not mention them at all. Outquote. apropos, is not correct, since Deutsch does mention Ginzburg. To Ginzburg and Rosalia Idelson refers Kulapko Koretsky in his memoirs. And on Ginzburg there are interesting comments in the memoirs by Jeronim Jasinski, Roman Mojej Zhizni. On the whole, however, Cherikover was right, complaining about the dearth of data in historical writing regarding Ginzburg and Rosalia Idelson, which may be partly explained by the fact that both of them, though for different reasons, severed, their ties with the revolutionary movements in the course of the 80s. Lev Savelyevich Ginzburg, who died in Petersburg in 1916 as a medical doctor, specialist in dentistry, hailed from the Russian Ukraine and attended what is known in Eastern and Central Europe as gymnasium in the town of Chernigov. He graduated from this school in 1876 or 67 or 68 and enrolled in the medical school of the University of Kyiv in 1868. His family lived in Chernigov, where they had probably a small business. Thus, after the father's death, which occurred in 70, the young Lev, since 1869, student of the medical school in Petersburg, Vojenno-Medicinska Akademia, had to support himself, which he did by giving lessons and working on translations. Ginzburg possessed practical abilities which made of him an irrepressible advisor to his fellow students and friends, and later on promoted him to a chief fundraiser of period. Jeronim Jasinski tells how Ginzburg procured work for him in 72. From correspondence between Ginzburg and Rosalia Idelson, we learn that Ginzburg, if not fully footed the bills of Rosalia in Zurich, at least largely contributed toward her budget there in the year 71-74. The same source reveals that Ginzburg arranged for some job for Rosalia Idelson's husband Smirnov, who at that time helped Lavrov with the first volume of period. Further, it was certainly Ginzburg who in 1874 induced the medical students to transmit to period the total amount of their collective funds, 1,000 rubles. It seems that he inherited from his businessman father certain ingenuity in dealing with daily life problems, which was happily married in him with innate decency, reliability, and common sense. A typical representative of the raznachinnaya or people's intelligentsia, he read Chernyshevsky and worshipped Chtodzielos, as well as he studied historical letters and became an admirer of their author Mirtov Lavrov. His attempts to promote medical studies of Rosalia Idelson in Switzerland were, of course, determined by the fact that he was in love with Rosalia, but also by his sense of duty to help, as he formulated it in one of his letters, I'm quoting, an intelligent, decent young woman wishing to support herself by her own work, output. He was a serious and gifted man who liked to study and who seemed to have been a little too bookish as compared with Narodnikov action. It is, for instance, impossible to imagine him in the role of a terrorist, but his perfect willingness to sacrifice himself for a cause, his readiness for self-denial, and his lack of egotism cannot be doubted. To obtain funds for period, in a moment when all normal sources were exhausted, Ginzburg, together with some other Lavrists, accepted a medical job in a region infested by bubonic plague and let period have the money they earned and this dangerous assignment. Although a recognized leader of the Lavrists in Russia, he hardly ever tried to be more than primus inter pares. Already at a school, at a schoolboy, he liked, according to Jasinski, exactness and had confidence in facts only. Hence his predilection for science. With permission of his principal, he organized a chemical laboratory in Chernigov Gymnasium. But abstract problems, too, were not alien to the precocious boy. As he was typical for a Jewish intellectual of his time, of the foreign languages, he knew German. And as early back as in his gymnasium years, he studied Kant in original. I'm quoting now Jasinski. I, as well as all his fellow students, were convinced that he would make a brilliant scholarly career. Output. Ginzburg, however, has chosen another road. I don't know whether it was to his liking, but certainly in accordance with his Weltanschauung and in the spirit of the idealistic tradition of the Russian intelligentsia. I am not able to indicate when exactly and under what influence Ginzburg became a socialist and a revolutionary. Jasinski reports that already in Chernigov, Ginzburg took part in kruzhki devoted to self-education and discussions of politically delicate topics. Later on, when in the medical school in the Kyiv University, he witnessed and probably got involved in the riots which by the end of the 60s occurred in the academic installations in the Russian capital and in provincial universities. It is interesting to note the names of youth he met in Chernigov and afterwards in Kyiv, nearly all of whom were related to the socialist opposition of the 70s. Armashevsky, Gerchanik, Rashevsky, Ivan Chernyshev, Varzak, Zubko Makrievich. Of them, only the first, Armashevsky, later changed drastically his outlook and switched to an extreme right wing. Of the others, from the point of view of period, Vasily Varzar is particularly important, a well-known statistician, an active supporter of the Lavris, and the author of the booklet Hitra Mechanica, the most popular propaganda tract used all over Russia in the revolutionary kruzhki of the 70s. Even more important in the framework of this study is another name, that of Sergei Padalinsky, whose anti-Semitic disposition has been recorded above. Padalinsky was one of the links in the chain which connected certain socialist groups with the founding of Period. The origin of Period, which still remains a mystery, cannot be discussed here. As far as Ginzburg is concerned, it is significant that it was southern Russia where the plan has been conceived to go to the author of historical letters, Lavrov, and suggest to him the establishment of a publication which became Period. It was not Padalinsky who was entrusted with such a mission, but Padalinsky not only was a courant of this plan, he was present in Paris early in 1872 when the delegation from Russia visited Lavrov. He went back to Russia and spent there the time between April and July 72 to collect funds for the publication suggested to Lavrov. And he followed the latter to Zurich, where Lavrov intended to draft a team for this period. It was not a pure coincidence that Ginzburg appeared almost simultaneously with Lavrov and Padalinsky in Zurich. Padalinsky knew well Rosalia Idelson, whom Ginzburg had met either in Petersburg or in the Ukraine sometime in 1869, or maybe even earlier. Since in August 69, he spent with her while in Nezhin and was then her, to say the least, close friend. In the summer of 1870, Rosalia Idelson is in Kyiv. She meets their friends of Ginzburg, and in the same year, she has letters from Padalinsky, which allusions to a revolutionary publication to be established for distribution in Russia. Ginzburg knew and informed Rosalia Idelson about the forthcoming trip of Padalinsky to Paris early in 72. It may therefore be assumed with a great degree of likelihood that Ginzburg and Rosalia Idelson were related to, or to be more cautious, had dealings with those who went to Lavrov and induced him to undertake the publication of Period. The delegation, which approached Lavrov in Paris in March 1872, did not even enter the annals of Period. Its members vanished from the scene as suddenly as their visit was unexpected by Lavrov. It so happened that their place was taken over by their friends or acquaintances, Ginzburg and Rosalia Idelson, for good, and Padalinsky for a while, who, together with people whom Lavrov selected in Zurich, the most outstanding among them, Valerian Smirnov, shouldered the heavy burden of establishing and of maintaining Period. While Smirnov and Rosalia Idelson acted together with Lavrov in Switzerland and later in Great Britain, Ginzburg, who returned to Russia in December 72 or in January 73, became the central figure of the Lavris in Russia for the years to follow. From time to time, he was making trips to the headquarters of Period. It was the case in 73, 74, 75, and 76. He also contributed articles to Period. These articles, particularly that entitled Letter to Graf Palen, reveal Ginzburg as an attentive and sober observer of the Russian life, whose eyes discerned and whose pen described with astonishing clarity the headway made by the capitalism in Russia after the reforms implemented by Alexander II. The letters by Ginsburg show him as irreconcilable, adversary of the Bakunist faction. Neither his articles nor his letters deal with any Jewish topics. He lived during the period we are dealing with beyond any Jewish problems, as if they would not exist for him, or as if he was completely detached from them. Therefore, it is interesting to register his reaction to an anti-Jewish remark by one of his contacts in Galicia, where he looked for means of smuggling period into Russia. This contact referred to Jewish smugglers rather scornfully. A Jew remains always a Jew. Seemingly shocked by such modest descent, Ginsburg hastened to correct the man by answering, they converse in German, ein Gelderwerber bleibt ein Gelderwerber. The third is the triumvirate, without whom Lavrov would hardly have been able to manage period, was a young woman, Razalia Kristaforovna Idelson, the first two being Smirnov and Ginsburg. Neither a writer nor a political leader, barely provided with any outstanding intellectual gifts, although energetic and positively non-foolish, probably charming, though hardly a beauty, she attracted men and possessed a real ability to inspire them. She also was liked, what happens less often with that type of girls, by members of her own sex, and she was always involved in some public affair. Her political activity came to an end when she became, rather late, a mother. Then, it was in the 80s, she abandoned definitely the revolutionary sphere of action, from which had already been removed since about 78-79, and devoted herself to her son, whom she adored. There are good reasons to believe that her socialist convictions were a bit superficial, and that her volatile mind gravitated with equal intensity towards ideas as towards fineries. But she could be a devoted friend, and her dedication to the revolutionary cause in the 70s was a genuine one. She did not lack courage, and perseverance was one of the striking features of her character. Razalia Idelson evidently was not the caliber of Vera Figner or Bardina or Anna Rosenstadt, Makarevich Turati, her contemporaries who adorned the Russian horizon in Turin. Her dealings and doings, I am aware of that, belong rather to the petite histoire of period. Nevertheless, without her, the history of period and of the Lavris would be incomplete. Born as Russia in Vilna on October 10, 1848, from Sarah Sheina and Haim Jakersberg, she ended her days during World War I in Petersburg as a wife of a Russian general, Evgeny Lakhnitsky, an army physician. An account of her life sounds like a plot of a novel of adventure, and as a matter of fact, to write about her would represent a gratifying task for a fiction writer. She was about 17 when Mikhail Sazhin, the right hand and confidant of Mikhail Bakunin in the 70s, arranged for her in the synagogue of Tsarskoye Selo a marriage with a student of Petersburg Technological Institute, a certain Idelson, hence her last name. The wedlock has been planned as a mariage blanc, with the purpose to withdraw young Razalia from the guardianship of her mother, who did not want her daughter to be influenced by Russian students, to whom she used to let rooms, and who became interested in Razalia and in her sister Anna. It's an open question whether Razalia's matrimony remained as it was conceived, a fictitious one. Sazhin, to whom we are indebted for this story, tells that the couple Idelson consummated their union. Anyhow, if it was not a mariage blanc, it was in any case a mariage de raison. I don't know what happened to Mr. Idelson, but from the life of Razalia, he vanished completely shortly after the marriage. Razalia earned for an education. She longed for a profession which would make her independent. She dreamed to be trained as a physician. In Russia of that time, It was quite difficult, if not impossible, to attain such a goal for a girl in general, for a girl without Miss in particular, or for a Jewish girl, Pal de Schulemarsche. As far as I could establish, Razalia had never attended gymnasium. All she can be credited with was a teacher's diploma, домашняя учительница, house teacher. Obtained with the help of the same sergeant who, en passant, did appreciate not only her urge for education. To acquire a doctor's diploma, Razalia Iderson decided to go to Switzerland. In the meantime, she met Ginsburg, which apparently affected her correspondence with Sargent, who in 1868 and 69 lived under surveillance of the police in Vologda and complained that she did not write often enough to him. Ginsburg got some funds and promised to supply money. Some other financial resources became available to Razalia. And in August 71, she was already in Zurich, where she met Valerian Smirnov, a political emigre from Moscow, who became her husband. Ginsburg did not discontinue sending money to Zurich, although, as time went by, the source of Razalia's income became more and more scarce. Smirnov also took care of his wife within the limits of his very modest means. Still another man, Evgeny Anatolievich Lakhnitsky, whom Razalia knew in Petersburg and who took a job in Turkestan, helped from time to time. It was a hard life. But Razalia's strong will overcame trivial difficulties. She could not continue her studies in Zurich, tried without success to register in the Paris Medical School, and then settled in Bern, where only in 81 she finally attained her goal. At that time, Smirnov and his wife were not able to make ends meet, and Razalia decided to take medical examination in Russia. It is possible that already then she was prepared to leave Smirnov. At any rate, there are letters in the Smirnov archives written by Lakhnitsky in November and December 81 and in January 82 in which he implored Razalia to return to St. Petersburg, and she did it. I do not know when Razalia's mother moved from Vilna to Petersburg, and I cannot indicate anything about her father and brother Moishe. However, various letters preserved in Smirnov archives show that Razalia was well acquainted with and popular among the revolutionary youth of the Russian capital. She was related to Tchaikovsky, especially to the group of young women who formed a part of the Tchaikovsky organization. She attended school caucus Shkolny Kruzhok, which gathered at the home of the sister Kalnilov, knew well Abadovskaya, Skvartsova, and was on friendly terms with Mrs. Tsebrikova. Having had relatives in the Ukraine, she traveled to Kiev, Chernigov, Nezhin, took part in discussion, leading in final analysis the sending of a delegation to Lavrov. In Zurich, it took her not long to be appointed librarian of the Russian Students' Library, founded by Sargent in 72. It was Sargent who suggested to her, prior to the rupture between the Bakunins and the Lavris, to join the revolutionary organization planned by him. Wife of Smirnov, close friend of Ginsburg, and an old acquaintance of Podolinsky, she associated herself with the Lavris and undertook, early in 73, a risky trip to Russia on behalf of Perot. Lavrov had been attached to her, and she was one of those who he entrusted with the transcription of his manuscripts, which, due to his illegible handwriting, few people were able to decipher. When Perot moved to London, Razalia Iderson remained in Switzerland to go on with her medical studies. And it's touching to observe how thoughtfully all members of the Perot community in London, who truly had other and more burning worries, encouraged Razalia's efforts to graduate from medical school. Razalia Iderson knew literally everything about the Perot community in London and the Lavris propaganda in Russia. Smirnov used to write to her almost daily detailed letters which contained annals of Perot. Lavrov too, less often, but quite regularly corresponded with her. Separated geographically from London and Petersburg, she remained the first lady of the Lavris as long as his group was able to act. To exhaust the list of the Jewish Lavris, I have to introduce I have introduced, in addition to Ginsburg, Razala, Edelson, several people, some of whom are well known, most of whom, however, are either utterly forgotten or not known enough as Lavris, and all of whom had their share in the history of the period, although not all of them were Lavris' pure son. These people are, in alphabetical order, Jochelson, Mandelbaum, Margolin, Pavlovsky, Sapper, Schnee, Chudnovsky, and Weissmann. Jochelson and Chudnovsky left detailed memoirs, and for the purpose of our studies suffice to register their names only. And Mandelbaum, I am able solely to record his story about students in the Swiss university place in the period. On the other, I have to dwell somewhat longer. Sapper Grigori, or Girsch, Grigori Davidovich, was born and died in Petersburg in 1849 and in 1902, respectively, and who left Russia for abroad in 72, wrote in London on January 1st, 76, to the editorial board of period. I'm quoting, "This is the fourth year that I live in a foreign country. You opened my eyes by supplying me with your publication." Output. He became a frequent guest in the London premise of period and felt a genuine friendship to Lavrov and Smirnov. He met, of course, the Jewish typesetters of period, Goldenberg and Lieberman, and was like them a founder member of the Agudas Socialistim Haivrim, which he wanted to convert into a Bildungsverein. It seems that non-Jewish socialist activities drew his attention even stronger than those of the Aguda. In November 75, he joined the committee of the Internationale Arbeiter Association in London. He prepared for period a report on the international rally organized in London by political refugees from various countries. The Smirnov archives preserved his invitation addressed to the period community, in which he urged dear compatriots to take part in a gathering against the treatment inflicted upon the former French communard in the New Caledonia, and his lengthy letter discussing the exploitation of Jewish workers, newcomers in London. He also was one of the speakers in a meeting called on the occasion of the third anniversary of the Polish uprising of 1863. Margolin and Pavlovsky both were involved in the so-called Great Trial, Process Study 93, and both were released since the police lacked evidence against them. Their subsequent relation to the period remained unknown to the authorities and to the editors of the Biobibliographische Slovar II. Margolin, Maisei Isakovich, called in the period circles Maisev, Vasily Ivanovich, Maisei Ivanovich, born in 1851 in Kherson, deported to Siberia in 79, and returned to European Russia 7 years later, was a student first of the Odessa University and then of the Medico-Chirurgical Academy in St. Petersburg. According to the Biobibliographische Slovary, Margolin, arrested in connection with going into the people, Harzhenyev Narod, was released only in February 1976. But Smirnov refers to him in his letter to Rosella Edelson on December 6, 75. I cannot reconcile the discrepancy. And tells that Margolin is in London, where he is busy studying Marx. He remained in the British capital about 6 months and worked as a typesetter in the period. He returned to Russia early in the summer 76 as a full-fledged Lavrist, contacted in Moscow the period representative there, Dmitry Ivanovich Richter, and proceeded via Odessa to his native Kherson. From Odessa, he sent to London a report on the break between the Lavrist and the Nathanson group, which occurred in St. Petersburg, and the Lavrist activities in southern Russia. Pavlovsky, Aron Yakovlevich, brother of Isaac Pavlovsky, a turncoat who started as a revolutionary and ended as a contributor to the reactionary newspaper Novoye Vremya, approached period in April 77 from New York, where he had a job with some store supplying commodities to Russian boats. He benefited from this situation to conduct revolutionary propaganda among Russian sailors. In the USA, he assumed the name of Hertz, left in autumn of the same year New York for Ohio to work on a farm from where he maintained contact with Nikolai Tchaikovsky. Since 77 was the year of the beginning of the end of the Lavrist, it is doubtful whether Pavlovsky's approach to period had any tangible results. His name has not been dropped from the study for the sake of accuracy. There remain two brothers, Samuel Abramovich, Schnee, and Boris Abramovich Weissman, who hailed from southern Russia and who were contact men of Piotr in Constantinople, Turkey. How it happened they had different last name, I don't know. The senior of them, Samuel, had been converted to the socialist faith by Russian revolutionaries. Among these acquaintances were the well-known Narodnik Ivan Martinovich Kowalski and a member of a technical staff of Period, a typesetter, Yakov Vasilyevich Vashchakin, the latter, an interesting type of a Russian educated worker, a seeker of truth, versed in the Holy Scriptures and devotee of Period, accepted from time to time jobs on Russian boats as a stoker to proselytize among their crew, and particularly to draft agents able or willing to smuggle Period into Russia. On one of his trips, he probably discovered in Constantinople a young Jewish retoucher, photographer, who escaped from Russia to avoid the draft. Samuel Schnee proved to be a good liaison between Period and the Russian sailors drafted by Vashchakin. Moreover, Schnee on his own conducted revolutionary propaganda among Russian sailors and even among Greek Orthodox pilgrims passing Constantinople on their way to Jerusalem. He was also interested in the situation of working classes in the Turkish capital and supplied Period with information gathered by him. On October 27, 1775, he wrote to London, I am quoting, "Thanks to my knowledge of Yiddish," he writes Jewish language, Hebrewski, but I am sure he meant Yiddish, "I succeeded in collecting data on tailors and shoemakers' output. This data apropos were used in this period. The sailors informed Schnee about their life. Thus, he was able to compile for Period a story, revolt on the boat Azov. He was apparently informed about the plans of Lieberman. Thus, in his letter, quoted above, he refers to our future Jewish printing shop. The beginning of the contact between Schnee and Period dates from August 75. About 1 year later, he decided to return home. But it was not his intention to forsake the cause. He found a deputy, his younger brother, Boris, who introduced himself in Period in November 76 in the following terms, I'm quoting, "It is with joy that I take upon me duties of my brother Samuel, and I want to be helpful to you in forwarding your publications to Odessa and to other places." He kept his promise, remaining at his post until July 78. It is a moot question how deep was the Lavrys' alignment of both brothers, Samuel and Boris. In one of his letters, dated November 376, Samuel told Period that he was willing to forward ausgerechnet Nabat of Tkachev to Russia. One can imagine the consternation caused by this letter in London. The scope of this study is too limited to allow any far-reaching conclusions. However, the material at our disposal justifies some closing remarks regarding socialists, Jews, whom we met in the framework of the Period activities. The attitude of this socialist towards Jewry was about the same as that of Jews who in the 70s joined other revolutionary groups. All of them rebelled against the established political and social system prevailing in Russia, as well as against the traditional Jewish heritage. And it seems that their repudiation of the latter was even stronger than that of the former. It was in the spirit of the time, of that time, that they, like non-Jewish socialists in and outside of Russia, underestimated or even refused to attach any importance to national problems. Cosmopolitan outlook, which characterized the 70s, but also the following decennia until the emergence of Bund, has been actually revised in Russia not before World War I. Les hommes de bonne volonté, using the term of Jules Romain, Socialist Jews of the 70s professed a complete indifference towards all things Jewish. It can be asked, wrote Vladimir Yochelson, why we wanted to be active within the Russian and not the Jewish people. This finds its explanation in our estrangement from the culture of the Russian Jews and in our negative assessment of their religious and bourgeois leaders. Regarding the Jewish lower classes, we thought that the liberation of the whole Russia would bring a long liberation of all nations living there. One has to admit that the Russian literature has instilled in us a view that Jewry was not a nation, but a parasitic class outcome. Of course, Jewish socialists, such as Lieberman, did not share fully this view, but they constitute a minority. As has been pointed out earlier, some socialist Jews refer to Jews as Jidy, Kikes. Aaron Pavlovsky wrote to Spirot from New York that he was employed by a Jid who supplied commodities to Russian boats in New York Harbor. Aaron Zundelevich told Spirot that he was negotiating with Jidy to arrange for smuggling of a revolutionary publication to Russia. To be as close as possible to the poor, oppressed, and miserable Russian peasant, a man of great heart and of fine feelings, Osip Aptekman, became converted to Greek Orthodoxy. It is therefore interesting to note that in certain situations, socialist Jews identified themselves with Jewish people. This was on rare occasions when they confronted with overt anti-Semitism on the part of some of their non-Jewish comrades, and particularly after the pogroms of the 80s. Osip Aptekman sent in 87 a moving letter to his old friend Pavel Axelrod, in which he wrote that his heart was bleeding when he heard about anti-Jewish outbursts in southern Russia. On the whole, however, socialist Jews in the 70s, of the 70s, became gradually more and more alienated from the Jewish collectivity and ultimately adopted completely Russian culture, and many of them were absorbed by the dominating Russian nation. Atheistic as they were, they lacked religious ties with the Jewish traditions. Internationalism, as they professed it, deprived them of a will to develop Jewish secular culture, regardless whether such one was viable or not. There have been several avenues which led the young Jewish intelligentsia away from their own milieu. Socialism of the 70s was one of them. This is not meant as a Werturteil, but only as a factual statement. My knowledge of the Russian, Jewish, Yiddish, and Hebrew bell letters is very scanty, and I don't know whether there are novels depicting Jewish youth of the 70s, as for instance Levanda did for the 50s and 60s, and Sholom Ash for the World War First period, Three Cities. Gorky once suggested to republish in Russia a series which he called The History of a Young Man, having in mind books like Rouge et Noir, Education Sentimentale, or Confession de l'Enfant du Siècle. A similar oeuvre dealing with Jewish youth from the 70s up to the emergence of the Bund would present a picture of assimilation resulting from a conversion to the socialist faith. Thank you.
Die unvorausgesehene Lage, das hat es geschaffen durch einen sehr interessanten und sehr äußerlichen Referat von Dr. Zapier. Ich brachte es zur Zeit nicht. Der Weiner will es benötigen.
Ich wollte machen, dass ich einen Vorschlag, den ich hoffe, dass ich